You are listening to the Middle East Institute's podcast series. To support MEI's programs and podcasts, please donate at www.mei.edu. Thank you for your support.
So when our panelists have their microphones on, we'll move into our first panel, entitled The Enduring Lessons of Operation Provide Comfort. Our Kurdish participant, Dr. Khaled Saleh, was unable to travel to Washington in time for our event and will participate by Skype. On stage, though, we have three distinguished American veterans of Operation Provide Comfort from various fields of government and the military. To moderate the discussion between them, we are joined by one of the most highly respected foreign affairs journalists in Washington, Ms. Karen DeYoung. Ms. DeYoung is an associate editor and senior national security correspondent for The Washington Post. She has served as bureau chief in Latin America and London, and as a correspondent covering the White House, U.S. foreign policy, and the intelligence community. She has been the paper's assistant managing editor for national news, national editor, and foreign editor. She has won numerous awards for national and international reporting and is the author of Soldier, a 2006 biography of Colin Powell. We are really delighted that she is with us today to lead this conversation. Karen will introduce our panelists and review some of the basic facts of what happened in OPC. We will then present a 3-minute video clip. After that, Karen will start the discussion on stage and with Professor Saleh, who has joined us from Skype. Hello, sir. Okay. And then she'll eventually turn to the audience for questions. Karen, please get us started. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark. Is this on? Are we good? Thank you. Good morning and welcome to the first of our two panels today. This afternoon, we're going to look at whether and how Operation Provide Comfort is applicable to some of the problems that currently face U.S. policymakers and people on the ground and, of course, the people of Syria. But this morning, as Mark said, we want to look back and talk about what actually happened in northern Iraq, in Kurdistan, during the operation that began in April of 1991. And I don't think we could have a better group to describe all aspects of that operation, both civilian and military. I'm going to describe them, introduce them in the order I've written them down here, not necessarily the order that they're sitting in. Retired Army Lieutenant General Jay Garner, in the middle here, was a commander on the ground during the Persian Gulf War, and within months after it was over, was sent to command the Operation Provide Comfort Joint Task Force headquartered in Zaqo. He was the only U.S. commander who was actually based in Iraq during the operation. Among his many other important jobs, he served as head of the U.S. Army Space and Strategic Defense Command and concluded his military career as Assistant Vice Chief of Staff, retiring in 1997. For his sins, he returned to Iraq in 2003 as Director of Reconstruction and humanitarian assistance following the Second Gulf War, and perhaps that's the subject of another day. Bob Kimmitt served as Treasury Secretary under President George W. Bush, but his long and very distinguished career in public service before that includes 3 Bronze Stars and a Purple Heart in the U.S. Army. He was Executive Secretary and General Counsel to the National Security Council, General Counsel to the Treasury Department, and Ambassador to Germany. During the period we're most concerned with, Bob was Under Secretary of State for Political Affairs at the State Department in 1991 during both the war and Operation Provide Comfort, in charge of negotiating with allies to form both the war and post-war coalitions. Andrew Natsios, to my left, served as administrator of the U.S. Agency for International Development from 2001 to 2006, managing reconstruction programs in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Sudan, and also served as U.S. Special Envoy to Sudan. He's a former head of the non-governmental aid agency World Vision. As an officer in the Army Reserve, he served as executive director of the Kuwait Task Force during Operation Desert Shield and Desert Storm, taking a break from his civilian job as director of Office of Foreign Disaster Assistance at USAID. And it was in that job that he returned immediately after the war, just in time to direct the office's role in Operation Provide Comfort. Professor Khaled Saleh on the screen, until March, was Vice Chancellor of the University of Kurdistan, Hewler, an English language university in Erbil in the Kurdish region of Iraq. He has served as senior advisor to the KRG prime minister and as KRG spokesman. Now an independent scholar, he has participated in and written extensively about the development of the Kurdish regional government, its politics, its institutions, its economy. Before we give our panel the floor, I'd like to set the scene a little bit. For most Americans, I think the 1991 Desert Storm conflict was an unadulterated victory. Saddam Hussein was driven out of Kuwait. His forces were roundly defeated by the United States and its allies. Some were critical that then-President George H.W. Bush did not order U.S. forces to move on to Baghdad and remove Saddam Hussein from office. But many in this country thought that the Iraqi leader had been sufficiently weakened that his own people, joined by a disillusioned and defeated Iraqi military, could and would overthrow him. In fact, the Bush administration urged them to do so. But Saddam was far from defeated, and when the Shia in the south and the Kurds in the north rose up against his rule in the weeks following the February end of Operation Desert Storm in 1991, the Sunnis who formed the bulk of the Iraqi military did not join them. These uprisings, as we've heard, were brutally repressed by Saddam Hussein, and the assistance that many expected from the United States and its allies did not materialize. For the Kurds in the north, memories of previous campaigns against them set off a panic. In late March, more than 1 million people, by some estimates, fled into the mountains of neighboring Turkey and Iran. In freezing temperatures, cut off from food, water, and shelter, pursued by the Iraqi military, their situation quickly turned into a humanitarian disaster. And by the first week in April, by some estimates, 1,000 people were reported to be dying every day. As we've heard, the United Nations Security Council quickly convened and passed Resolution 688, which called on Saddam to stop repression against his own people and the international community to move to alleviate the humanitarian suffering. Interestingly, it did not mandate or even mention the possibility of a no-fly zone. First, the British, joined by the Americans and the French, created a task force to conduct humanitarian operations. Quickly became apparent that a security component would be necessary both to facilitate the aid, protect the Kurds from Saddam, and eventually to move them back into their homeland and ultimately turn aid operations over to international organizations. The first phase of Operation Provide Comfort lasted until July of 1991. It involved some 20,000 U.S. and coalition troops on the ground with extensive air support. The second phase, with minimal ground forces and most humanitarian tasks undertaken eventually by NGOs, included the no-fly zone conducted by American, French, and British air assets to prohibit the Iraqi government forces from entering the area. It lasted in various forms pretty much up until the 2003 war that, in fact, overthrew Saddam Hussein. Meanwhile, under international protection, the Iraqi Kurds settled at least some of the internal rivalries that had plagued them for decades and established the politics and institutions of a modern government. Operation Provide Comfort is widely viewed as a success. There were numerous problems, and some hard lessons were hopefully learned. But it succeeded in saving thousands of Kurdish lives, it reduced ethnic pressure on Turkey, and it prevented Saddam Hussein from having a free hand, setting a precedent for the establishment of no-fly zones to protect civilians. But in those bleak days at the end of the winter of 1991, little of that seemed possible. And as you'll see in a brief video prepared by the good people here at Washington Institute, the Kurds were destitute. I think we're ready to show the video.
In March, 600,000 Kurdish people fled from Iraq to the mountains on the Turkish border to escape from Saddam Hussein's troops. Despite appalling conditions in the makeshift camps, terror kept the refugees clinging to the mountains.
Kuwait is 1 million. 1 million. He do this all war for 1 million. We are 5 million. Saddam Hussein bombing, bomba, helicopters. destroyed us. I don't know. They saw this, but they don't know why. We are human like you.
On the Turkish border, up to 1,000 refugees are said to be dying every day. At least 400,000 are living in appalling conditions.
According to the military governor of this region, 1 million Kurds have already crossed into Iran, and another 500,000 are clogging the roads behind me. That queue, we're told, stretches for 40 miles. This is a whole people on the move.
At first light, the bodies of the children who died in the night are brought down from the mountain at Çukurca. Hundreds have been killed by cold, hunger, and diseases caused by the filth around them, despite the relief effort.
The Americans have gone into action on both sides of the frontier. Their special forces have been dropped by helicopter into hostile territory to survey possible campsites and to assess the potential threat from Saddam Hussein's army. A-10 Warthogs have been flying shotgun above.
These American Marines are a short distance from Iraq. They're ready to go in at any time to set up a safe haven. The problem is going to be trying to persuade the people in the mountains beyond they will be protected from Saddam Hussein.
The first ones to leave the mountains were those who had no choice. The sick, mostly the very young, as well as many pregnant women. To stay could have meant death. For the most urgent cases, helicopters were needed. Food was no longer the greatest problem. Tons of supplies were arriving daily. Army rations had relieved the immediate famine, and basic provisions were getting through, enabling the refugees to cook for themselves. It wasn't surprising that some of the refugees wanted to cling on to the men who'd given them the safety and compassion they hadn't experienced for years.
We don't want them to leave us here. We don't want, because I think we will die here, for sure.
In March, 600,000 Kurdish people fled from Iraq to the mountains on the Turkish border to escape from Saddam Hussein's troops. Despite appalling conditions in the makeshift camps.
Bob Kimmitt, what was going on inside the administration at that point? How much of a responsibility was felt to assist the Kurds? Was there pushback that this war was finished and public and congressional support wasn't there? There's a story, maybe it's apocryphal in some respects, that Secretary of State Baker went to the border, walked among the Kurds, and specifically called for the TV cameras to come up and watch him step across the border into Iraq and promise that there was going to be assistance.
Karen, thanks. I'll answer your question. I would just answer it, though, maybe by opening the aperture a little bit, just to give the context. But first, I'd like to thank Middle East Institute, Tony Zinni, Wendy Chamberlain, Mark Sheelan for putting this important conference together. It's nice to be back on stage with trusted colleagues and to see some in the audience, Jim Jamerson and Sandy Charles and many others who are involved throughout this process. I would also note that Karen was introduced as a senior foreign affairs correspondent. I think you actually use the term now senior national security correspondent. And that's important because national security really is the combination of foreign affairs, defense, intelligence, international economics. And when you take a look at something like provide comfort, it has all of those elements at play. And you have here the epitome of civil-military cooperation in Andrew Natsios and Jay Garner. And they can talk in a lot more detail than I in terms of what happened on the ground. But just to step back for a moment, in March, let's say, of 1991, we had been focused on Desert Shield and Desert Storm for 7 months. Nothing had a higher priority. But other things were going on in the world. We were 4 months away from the coup against Gorbachev. We were 8 months away from the end of the Soviet Union. Things were not going well in Ukraine and the Baltics. They were going even worse in Yugoslavia. We had successfully gotten Soviets out of Afghanistan, Cubans out of Angola, Vietnamese out of Cambodia, but those were still very fragile post-conflict situations. I would also say that we were paying attention, perhaps not as much attention as we should have, to how close North Korea was getting to its nuclear capability. So there were other things going on. I think with regard to Iraq, we were very clear on what we didn't want, maybe not as clear on what we did want. And I think that permeated into what happened in the north. We didn't want a Lebanization of Iraq. We didn't want problems with Turkey. We didn't want involvement by Iran. We didn't want there to be a civil war in Iraq. We certainly didn't want to reintroduce U.S. forces. And as you mentioned, we wanted to try to hold the coalition together, in part because part of what we had promised the coalition was that we would turn very quickly to the Middle East peace process after Saddam was ejected from Kuwait. And in fact, it was on his second trip to the region in pursuit of Middle East peace that Jim Baker, on April 8, 1991, went into the area and saw the human tragedy at play. I don't know about him calling the cameras over or going into Iraq. I know he did call me and say, get with the program. Whatever we're doing is not enough. Andrew and I had been in close contact for several weeks. We had had an interagency process working, but not, I don't think, with the urgency that we really needed. And I think it was the secretary seeing that firsthand that energized the process, not only with a call to me, which is always energizing, but also he had put in a call to Secretary Cheney and others and said, clearly, this is a human tragedy of epic proportion. We have to do more. And I'd say that that sort of gets to the bureaucratic point that I'd end up with, and that is we had been having, really since the 1st of August, 1990, very regular meetings of the Policy Coordination Committee, the Deputies Committee, the small group, the NSC, the Group of Eight. When we secured not only military victory, but the goal of Resolution 660 by ejecting Saddam from Kuwait, I think there was a collective exhalation on the part of the U.S. government and probably the coalition. And in retrospect, that was premature. I mean, it turns out that the consequences of victory can be as unpredictable as the consequences of defeat. And I was taught as a young military officer that those actions on and after the objective are as important as seizing the objective. And I would say that we had done a good job in seizing the objective, ejecting Saddam from Kuwait, but we didn't, in my view, integrate our post-war thinking into the planning process early enough to have dealt with this situation as quickly as we did. I think, as you said, it was eventually a success. I think we could have done a better job of being prepared for, again, that unpredictability of success and victory.
Well, I wonder, General Garner, if you can follow on that in terms of what the feeling was inside the military. This was basically asking you to turn on a dime. You'd won the war, thought it was over. As Bob pointed out, you had lots of other things going on. This was something that required an enormous amount of resources. To what extent were plans in place for this kind of operation or not? And how difficult was it to switch gears that quickly?
I got a phone call in my quarters in Germany, and 3 nights later I was sleeping on the floor of a bombed-out building in northern Iraq. So it's pretty pretty quick. Bayan made a comment about flying over. She thought, what was it? Tony Zinni and Jim Jamerson, myself, and General Shali Kashvili flew over one morning. We flew over the mountains in Turkey, that right up against the Iraqi-Turkish border. And the mountains came through the clouds, and on the peaks were crowded with thousands and thousands and thousands of Kurds. And I looked down and I thought, Shali said, God, how many people do you think that is? And somebody said, it's got to be at least 500,000. And I thought, how in the world are we going to get them out of here? How are we going to do that? And then that afternoon, I got in a Black Hawk, and I flew over into northern Iraq to look for some landing zones for the 2nd, 8th Marines, where we were going to air mobile in the next morning. And I kept seeing these places on the ground that looked like they'd been bleached out, were thousands of square kilometers. And I landed at one of them, and it was just a bunch of rocks and rubbles and everything. Well, actually what it was, it's where villages had been. And Saddam Hussein had come in and gassed and killed the Kurds and destroyed the vision. There was over a thousand of those, a couple of thousand of those. And they were all over northern Iraq. Since then, I've been back many, many times. And Kurdistan is really, you know, it is the other Iraq. It's the Iraq that we wanted and didn't get. It's democratic, you know, democratic Chicago politics. Well, what the hell, it's pretty close. And it's, until the war, the economy was pretty good. There were pretty good roads, great crops, fine hotels, fine restaurants. I think often that all this has happened in 25 years. When Jim Jones, John Abizade, myself, and Fred Cooney walked across the Harbor Bridge back into Turkey in July of 91, I turned to them and I said, they can't make it. There's no way they can make it. And now I go back and look at that, and I think often that not since Nehemiah went into Jerusalem and finished the rebuilding of Jerusalem has a group of people come together with their own courage, their own innovation, their own energy, and their own stamina and built back a civilization that they have. So you don't find that. I don't think you find that anywhere else in history. One thing that we had is we had a very tight chain of command. Jim Jamerson and Tony Zinni had been in charge of the war effort out of Incirlik, and they had a very good staff. They had been there. They knew the country. They knew the Turks. They had a good intel system. So when we went into northern Iraq, we were kind of a pickup team of Americans, Brits, Spanish, Italians, Dutch, French, and several other countries on a smaller scale. We kind of had to come together, and we came together under what we call tactical control, where I had tactical control of the Allied units, but really I didn't have tactical control of them. Tony Zinni explained it best to General Powell when General Powell said, what do you got here, OpCon or TACON? And Tony said, we got HandCon. It's called a handshake. And that's about what we had there. But the commanders were all very close. Up in the mountains, you had Dick Potter and the Special Forces guys who are superb at doing the things they were doing. I mean, they stopped the dying. And I think the CDC estimated about 6,700 died on the border there in April and May, and God knows how many died in March, more than that in March. But the Special Forces guys, they not only stopped the dying. They got the Kurdish leaders together. They had them design the pattern that they wanted the tents placed in the refugee areas. They designed the latrines that they wanted. So they incorporated them in everything that up in the mountains that we were going to do in northern Iraq. The other thing is, while we brought this diverse coalition element together in northern Iraq to do provide comfort, we weren't strangers. Jim Jones had worked with Andy Keelan, the British commander, on an operation. I had just finished the month before working with the French on an operation. At John Abizade, who commanded the Army Airborne Unit, had worked with the Italians. The only outlier were the Spanish, and that was the first time that they had deployed outside of Spain on a military operation since 1898, when they deployed to fight us in the Spanish-American War. The second thing there that was interesting, every unit there wanted a piece of action. Every unit wanted to be there. Every soldier, every Marine wanted to be there because they had missed the war. They had all missed the war, and they wanted a piece of what was left. And so there's immense desire on the part of the military to be there and do good among the Brits, the U.S., the Italians, and the French, and again the Spanish, because they wanted to do good because it's their first time out in almost 100 years. So the units all came together. The other thing that was significant was the effort of USAID and the DART teams, and they were magnificent. I think a lot of that, Mike Hess is here, he was one of them, but I think a lot of that was on the broad shoulders of Fred Cooney and the organization that he had, Intertech. But they did a massive amount of work to include harvesting the crop, which is mammoth, to be able to harvest the crop. The other thing we had was a tremendous amount of discipline on the part of the military. I mean, it probably unmatched. I think unmatched anywhere else that I'd been, but superb discipline on their part, which many times when they could have returned fire or they could have initiated fire, they didn't do it. Their discipline stopped them from doing it. And that kept a lot of things. But I'll give you one quick story. We had one of the Marines named Lars Chu, a PFC named Lars Chu, stepped on mine and blew off his legs. And we eventually medevaced him that evening back into Turkey. And it was not one of the Marines, a soldier, one of John Abizade's soldiers. And that night, Abizade went to see him, he and his first sergeant and his sergeant major. And Chu said, "Sir, you're going to jump back into Italy when you get back?" He said, "I'll be on the drop zone waiting on you." And Abizade slew him. He came back, and about an hour later, Chu died. So the next morning, Abizade took every paratrooper he could find for memorial service. He only left those that were patrolling, those on security. And Jim Jones brought in his Marines, as many as Marines could. And we had this huge memorial service there in northern Iraq. And the chaplain was going to deliver the service, and we had two sergeants who were going to give eulogies, and then one sergeant was going to sing Amazing Grace. The chaplain got about 5 minutes into it and cracked up. He got too emotional. So one sergeant came up to give a eulogy. He got too emotional, couldn't do it. The second sergeant, same way. The third sergeant came up singing Amazing Grace, and we got on the second verse, his voice cracked it. He couldn't finish. And the memorial service just ended. It was never finished. It just ended because of emotion. So we all left. I got in my helicopter. I had to go down and see Dick Nabb, where he was negotiating with Iraqis, and I met the Iraqi general. And the night before, we had medevac a Marine out of Tony Corwin's 2nd and 8th Marines. And the Iraqis had fired on the helicopter coming in. They didn't come close or anything. And so Corwin never returned fire. And they got the Marine out. I think he had appendicitis. So I went down and met the general. I said, "Let me tell you something. The next time you guys have done this before, the next time you do, we will light you up. We'll kill every damn one of you. And don't you forget it. We'll come in there, we'll kill every one of you if you do that again." He said, stop. And he reached over for my knife. I had to put his hand on it, and I put my hand. He said, "We'll fly over to my lines. I'll line up my soldiers. I'll take your knife and I'll cut three of their throats to show them that we mean business." And I said, "No." So he reached for my pistol and I put my hand up. He said, "I'll take your pistol, I'll shoot them." I said, "We're not going to kill any of your soldiers to administer discipline. We're going to kill you if it happens again. You understand it?" But I just thought, I thought, what a difference in the culture of two organizations. You know, you had the Western armies and then that army, and the cultures were immense. The day I left, a Kurdish child, young boy, 10 years old, ran out of the crowd and handed me a folder. And I took that folder and gave it to my radio operator, and we walked back across the bridge. And that night I was in my tent. He came in and he said, "Hey, did you ever look at this?" I said, "No." He said, "You got to see this." And he laid out four drawings, wonderful drawings, of soldiers and children. And the soldiers throwing them up in the air and giving them candy and playing with them and all that. And I thought, you know, 3 months ago when we came in here, every time they saw a soldier, they ran, because nothing good can come from seeing a soldier. And 3 months later when we leave, everything good comes from soldiers. And that, what a great testimony to democracies and the armies of democracies. And then the last thing I'll say is one of the reasons Provide Comfort did so well is because they left us alone. You know, Bob just talked about it. The president was sick for part of the time, and Baker was busy, as busy could be the Russians and the Europeans, and Powell and Cheney were trying to get 500,000 soldiers back out of Saudi Arabia, and they didn't think about us. They didn't think about us for a month. When they finally thought about us, they came and screwed up a lot of stuff, but we already had most of it done. Yeah. And then finally, the final thing I'll say is that's good, because you only got a very short window in an operation like this, and the window closes pretty fast, and the thing that has to happen is you have to remain a liberator as long as you can, because when the window closes, you're an occupier. That's the last thing you want to happen. I don't know if that answered your question, but it was fun.
Andrew Natsios, how much time did you have to prepare for this operation? And what was it like? What were you asked to do? There was some initial criticism that, and I think it was mostly against the military and not yourselves, that there were some mistakes made in the aid that was chosen, the way it was delivered, pallets hit people. But did you feel like you had a good handle from the start on what the needs were?
Well, let me put this in context. I was a major at the time. I think I got promoted to lieutenant colonel just after I got back in my reserve. I was a civil affairs officer. But I was the executive officer of the Kuwaiti Task Force, which worked with the Kuwaiti cabinet in exile to plan the reconstruction of Kuwait. You don't know much about that because it was very successful. It wasn't controversial at all. But we brought Fred Cuny, this very famous humanitarian figure. I brought him with me while I was in active duty, put a uniform on. He was part of our unit, effectively. And when I couldn't go through the command structure, I would have him do things that, because he wasn't actually under anybody's command except mine in a personal sense. But he came, and then Joe Gedier came to Kuwait as well, who's a Foreign Service Officer from OFDA. OFDA, the Office of Foreign Disaster Assistance, does the U.S. government's civilian response to emergencies abroad. We had worked with the military for decades on natural disasters. This is the first time we ever worked with the military on what we call a complex humanitarian emergencies, where there are atrocities, mass starvation, mass population movements, collapsed states, and wars. That was the first time, I think, historically, that that happened. And so I came back from Iraq as an officer, immediately went back, took my position as director, and we had four DART teams. A DART team is a disaster assistance response team. We had just, Julia Tapp was my predecessor, who was the head of OFDA. Sadly, she has since died. She was a major humanitarian figure. She invented the DART team, but then she resigned before we could implement it. So I took over, and my job was to create the DART team, of course, through the career people who know how to do this. And the first team we ever deployed to a complex emergency like this was to northern Iraq. So this is the first time we did this. We sent Fred with Dayton Maxwell, who is the head of the DART team. He's a Foreign Service officer from AID. And deputy head of OFDA, with $30 million budget, and I think we sent 20 or 30 people, which for that was a lot of people. The reason I say it's a lot of people, the entire office, OFDA, had 48 career staff and 12 contractors, 60 people, and a base budget of $55, $60 million. Congress gave us another $200 million because there was a massive increase in these kinds of chaotic, complex emergencies, a quadrupling of them as the Cold War ended. It led to collapsed states all over the world. So we went from four of these emergencies a year to 20 by the time I left office, and the office was coming apart. We sent the DART team into Iraq, which had profound national security implications, but we had DART teams already in Ethiopia because at the same time Iraq was blowing up, the Mengistu regime was collapsing, and there was going to be a bloodbath in Addis. State, through Bob Fraser and Hank Cohen, succeeded in getting Mengistu to leave the country before we had a bloodbath. But there was the famine starting in Ethiopia, and then the northern government in Sudan had almost destroyed John Garang's army in southern Sudan, and there was about to be a massacre of southerners on a large scale. So we had a DART team there, and then the worst drought in the 20th century was taking place in southern Africa that affected 11 countries. We had a DART team there. At one point, when we sent the DART team out to Iraq, I said, we need another DART team. I can't remember where it was. And my secretary said, Andrew, the only person left in this office is the receptionist, you and me. You sent everybody else out to the field. There's no one else to send out. And I said, we need to hire more people. She said, we can't do that in 2 days. I have to tell a story. Bob Kimmett may forget this, but after Jim Baker flew into northern Iraq, he got off the helicopter. He saw what was happening. He called you up, and he said, get Natsios' teams out here. You don't remember this. You called me 6 times in 1 day. Every 2 hours, Jim Baker was in Israel, and he kept calling you, where is the DART team? I said, it takes us 2 days to deploy. We cannot do this in a few hours. You kept calling me. I said, Bob, it's the same report I had when you called me 2 hours ago. He said, well, Baker's calling me. I have to respond somehow. I said, tell him everybody's getting their passports. They're getting their equipment together, the communications equipment, and that was all deployed. So we were under severe stress. The second point I would make with respect to this is, and Jay alluded to this, but let me put it in starker relief. CUNY called me up Fred Kuhne was murdered in Chechnya in the mid-90s. We've never found his body. He's a revered figure among the Palestinians in Kuwait, who we protected because there were atrocities against the Palestinians after we defeated Saddam, because the PLO stupidly endorsed the invasion of Kuwait and promised Kuwait to the Palestinians to be their homeland, which didn't make the emir too happy. Then we went to northern, Fred is still revered among the Kurds in northern Iraq, as Jay Garner is. He's too modest to say that, but he is revered. And so Fred went in, and Dayton Maxwell and the DART team, and what they called me up in like a week, and they said, we've got a problem here. Jay Garner knows exactly what we need to do, which is we need to get the Kurds out of the mountains, which we can't force them to do it under an international humanitarian law, the Geneva Conventions, and the UN Charter. We cannot force refugees involuntarily to move anywhere. They have a right to stay where they are. We have to entice them back in a reasonable way, and there's a plan to do that. We've done it before. But UCOM and Washington, through the command structure, kept sending us basically a logistics plan to keep the Kurds up in the mountains forever. And Fred and Jay Garner and Dayton Maxwell, and then he also said nice things about General Campbell and General Jamerson. He said they all get it. The people in the field get it in the military, but the people don't get it at the higher end. And they kept sending these plans down, imposing them on General Garner and the U.S. military in the field. Now, what was very interesting, what happened, I told this to Eagleburger, and he said, you're coming with me to the Pentagon. I said, what am I going to the Pentagon for? We are going to meet with Admiral Jeremiah, the vice chairman, or Colin Powell. We did meet with Admiral Jeremiah, and I thought I was going to have a yelling match with him. I said, you can't keep sending these stupid plans down. That's not what we don't want to keep them up in the mountains. This is not a logistics operation. It's a resettlement operation, and then there has to be some protection for the Kurds later on, or they're not going to come down. Admiral Jeremiah said, Andrew, we don't know how to do this. We've never done this before. You are the experts. Fred Kuhne's a celebrated international figure. He knows how to do this stuff. So you tell me what you want the command structure to do. I said, tell them the DART team's in charge of policy. He said, you write the order, we'll send it out. And they sent the order out through General Powell. He signed it. And it caused a big stir, apparently, because I think they accused Jay Garner of having orchestrated this somehow to get them off his back. And that's what it did. And after that, the plan that Fred had put together with Jay Garner and the U.S. military is what was implemented. Now, the other part of the story, and I was going to go back and try to find the clipping. I don't know. Were you reporting for the Post then? Maybe you wrote it.
I was an editor.
Okay.
Sitting here.
Well, someone wrote this front page story, and it got me into a lot. I thought I was going to get fired as director of OFDA. Front page story from Fred Kuhne on the record and Dayton Maxwell saying, we are going to establish a no-fly zone. I said, oh my. I said, you didn't tell me this ahead of time. They released this to the Washington Post front page without any clearances from Washington. The desk officer in state went ballistic, said, the DART team is going to be immediately withdrawn. Kuhne's going to be fired. He's not even a direct hire of the U.S. government. And Dayton Maxwell's going to be thrown out of the Foreign Service. I said, I'm not withdrawing anybody unless Jim Baker tells me to or the president, and they're not going to do that. Within 24 hours, Baker and Scowcroft and the president and Bob Kimmett and you all said, this is a good plan. It was the U.S. plan. And I think you guys orchestrated this from the field. I don't know if you told Fred to leak that to the Washington Post, but it did. I was on the edge of getting fired. You would never have told Fred to do that. In any case, I have to go back and read the article because members of Congress were calling us and all that. So that's some of the political intrigue that took place. But did we have a plan for this? No, because we were under so much stress all over the world that there was no one left to do planning in Washington. Now, I have to say, we went from 60 people 25 years ago. There are now 400 and 25 people of career staff at OFDA. The budget went from 55, 60 million then to 950 million now. One last statistic. We spent $50 million at OFDA and Food for Peace in that few months in the emergency. However, from 1991 to 1995, that four-year period, AID spent in northern Iraq $794 million, almost $1 billion. in northern Iraq, helping the Kurds in that area. So there, and that's, this is through the NGOs. I think the military at the time didn't understand. The NGOs are principally funded by AID in these emergencies, along with many of the UN agencies. That's where they get the funding from donors, from the State Department, from AID. So anyway, those are my...
Yeah, there were three things that happened.
We have let's bring Professor Sali in. He's been very patient there. Are you still with us? Can you hear me?
Yes. Great. Yes, I am.
You've listened to our speakers talk about what was happening inside the U.S. government and how their planning went. But what was the feeling among the Kurdish population? Were people, at least initially, did they feel abandoned by the Americans? How confident were they that the Americans were going to follow through on this? Because as Andrew just said, it basically required cooperation, clearly, from the Kurdish people themselves. And what was your sense of what the Americans actually knew about Kurds and what they wanted at that point?
Let me just give one particular context which might be important for understanding of how the reaction came about. In the war over Kuwait, the Kurds came out of shadow of history and were used during the preparation and the war to liberate Kuwait as a testimony to what kind of regime the West were fighting against. So the Kurds came out of that shadow and were referred to in the media. There were a lot of references to the killings and to the gassing of the Kurds in the years before the war. So when the government of Saddam Hussein was weakened enough, or the army was weakened enough, the uprising gave a lot of hope. And at the same time, a lot of documentations came out, and that terrified the Kurds, particularly because the majority of the population were not actually exposed to the kind of suffering some of the population were subject to. So with the hope of uprising against the government, and with the abandonment of the uprising shortly after, one reference put the Kurds on panic. One of the government officials alluded to gassing again, and that started the whole movement into the neighboring countries. Shortly after arriving on the borders, 1 million, as some of you indicated already, and 500,000 in Iran and 500,000 on the Turkish side, the Turkish government made a move that actually saved the Kurds in the long run by not granting the asylum as they were expected to do. And that put a lot of pressure, of course, on the coalition forces. But that in the hindsight, compared to what happened in part of other conflicts, if you look at what happened in other part in Africa, and they remained refugees for generations, the Kurds who went back, they went back to the territory, and they went back to the community they were originating from. And that put a lot of pressure on the Kurdish leadership, although there were a lot of disappointment by not living up to the support they were announced initially, but also the immediate military or the immediate political support that did not come through led to a lot of disappointment among the Kurds. But initially, it put a lot of pressure on the Kurdish leadership. It allowed the Kurdish leadership to set up its own transition from being a resistance movement into a civil political system. They had to administer suddenly a traumatized population. They have to provide services, and they originally organized for the first election inside the country. What also made this transition very interesting from the Kurdish perspective is they did remain within the framework of Iraq throughout the years that led to 2003 war against Saddam Hussein. All the difficulties the population faced and all the sufferings they were subject to were somehow within this particular transition of coming out of history, a shadow of history, and becoming a historical player in a regional context, and also gradually on the international level after 2003 war against Saddam Hussein. So there was, in the hindsight, a mixture of disappointment, but also hope for a better future. And also the fact that the coalition forces did not link any political goal into the military intervention helped the Kurds not to have a lot of resistance in the neighboring countries about what was going on. Because the military focused entirely on the emergency rescues and humanitarian interventions, the fear of changing the borders, the fear of creating a Kurdish state were easing off gradually after the first initial reactions from the neighboring countries. And when the population went back, the focus of the Kurdish political elite or the Kurdish political forces were providing services and providing security to the population. In the hindsight, when you look at what happened in 2003, the operation Provide Comfort actually prepared the ground for the Kurds in Iraq to have a different experience from the collapse of the rest of Iraq. By 2003, there were a lot of experiments in institution buildings. Now, when the rest of Iraq collapsed in 2003, all the institutions that were created in the shadow of the Operation Provide Comfort survived and made it into the new phase of the post-Saddam Iraq. And that is where we see all the fruits, as Jay Garner referred to, into the development of democratic institutions, tolerance, even as the minister said, providing security for other internally displaced and refugees from Syria. These are all the fruits of that particular event that allowed the Kurds to become players in the regional context.
Thank you. I'm going to just throw out some questions now directed to one of the other of you, but please go ahead and jump in if you want to contribute. Bob Kimmon, I wanted to ask you pretty much the same as today. There were a lot of problems with Turkey, which had its own agenda in the region, its own concerns about the Kurdish population in its own country and in the region. They, as I understand it, limited the amount of time that their bases, air bases, could be used, and it was subject to renewal all the time. They limited the number of aircraft that could be used. Could you talk a bit about negotiating with the Turks and how that was done, and also maybe a little bit about Iran, because you were trying to get the Kurds to come back from there as well?
Yeah, I think the Turkish angle was a very important one, both in Desert Shield and Storm, and certainly in Operation Provide Comfort. I would start by saying that late in February of 91, at the latest early in March, we were actively considering, and in fact a recommendation had come out of the Deputies Committee for a no-fly zone in southern Iraq, because that's where the uprisings first really began. That's where we started thinking about some of the first humanitarian efforts that we needed to make. I think it was that fateful meeting on March 3rd where General Schwarzkopf basically said no fixed-wing flight, but did say yes to helicopters. But that was part of us taking a look at what was going on in the south, and part of that was to sort of also keep the Iranians at bay. I say that because the story that Andrew said about the no-fly zone in the north, you know, maybe you skipped over the bureaucratic process, and that wasn't that bad a thing. Wasn't that bad a thing to do. But the Turkish angle was really very important from the start. First of all, early on, we identified Turkey as absolutely crucial from both a political, military, and economic perspective to what we needed to do ultimately in Iraq. There was a group set up, often forgotten, called the Gulf Crisis Financial Coordination Group, and this was about 60 countries, most of whom, the majority of whom, were countries who could not contribute forces, so they helped contribute money to what were called the frontline states, Egypt, Jordan, and Turkey, who were suffering from the effect of UN sanctions against Iraq. So we looked at that from an economic perspective first. I would imagine the Secretary Baker and I were in Turkey as much as any place other than Saudi Arabia in the run-up to and after the war itself with Turgut Özal and others. My recollection is certainly during the war itself, they had been fairly forward-leaning in operational terms. Maybe Jim Jamerson can mention it, certainly by comparison to the very stiff-necked approach they took with regard to the Iraq war. And so we had tried to play that through. And in fact, I can remember on one of the last visits that we took to the region, must have been in December of 90 or January of 91, you know, Ankara was always a place to stop. We also went down to our air bases to talk to the military commanders. So I think the Turks were a major angle from the start, and it was actually in Turkey where Jim Baker was when he was calling me and I was calling you on April 8th. He was down in southeastern Turkey, and it was really a diversion. He was out there on a Mideast peace trip, and we weren't actually talking with the Turks about Mideast peace. We were talking with the Gulf Arab states, with Jordan, with Israel, Egypt, and others, but he made the diversion to go to Turkey, both first to see the Turks and then to see the situation that had developed. I think that was part of what animated the attention given to the crisis once Secretary Baker had seen it firsthand. Not only did it have a significant personal effect on him, but I think he knew it had a major strategic implication with a country, Turkey, that perhaps, although they were being difficult operationally at this point, had been a supporter of ours really from August 1st on. And so I think that Turkish dimension is really quite an important one. I don't recall as much, Karen, the sort of Iranian-Kurdish angle playing, at least at my level. It may have at an operational level, but at the senior level, the Turkish factor was crucial, really almost from the start of the crisis through the war and the after-war.
You, General Gardner, Mr. Natsios, you've both talked a lot about what a milestone this was in terms of civilian-military cooperation. But I think there's you've both hinted, too, that it wasn't always a really smooth road. Andrew, you wrote at one point in 95 that perhaps the most consistently difficult lesson for U.S. military forces is to learn that, unlike their role in combat, they are not in charge of managing the response to a complex humanitarian emergency. You've talked about how at the beginning of this process you had 60 people. We saw this subsequently in the Balkans, in Haiti, other places where there was that kind of joint action. And the civilians are so immensely outnumbered by the resources and the numbers and the kind of crispness with which the military operates. Could you talk about how you evolved this relationship? And as you said, in really the first complex humanitarian operation, of which there have been many since. I mean, I remember in Bosnia, where there was a lot of frustration about the military kind of moving in and taking over. Maybe that's because I mostly talked to the civilians. So I'm probably biased there. But I wonder if you could talk about how you both sort of felt your way toward this happening. Maybe one answer is what you said, to the extent that people up above didn't pay attention or there was a layer that you had to go all the way to the top beyond to get something moving. But what did you learn from that process?
I was trained as a military, as a civil affairs. I was actually an infantry officer originally when I went through IOBC at Fort Benning, Georgia in 1971 when I graduated from Georgetown in ROTC. So, you know, I knew military disciplines, not as well as an active duty officer, but I was in the reserves 22 years. And I saw the value, and I was accused when I retired from aid of militarizing AID. The DCMs for the European embassies had a party for me when I left to lunch, and the Swedish DCM got up and said, Mr. Natsios, the Europeans are saying you militarized aid. And I said, well, what does that mean? He said, well, you have manuals on how you operate in the field now for OFDA, which we didn't have years, but we have, it's called the FOG. I wouldn't have called it the FOG. It was Field Officer's Guide is the equivalent of an FM. And we did that actually after Kurdistan. We started having this FOG, and the FOG is still there. It used to be this thick, now it's this thick. And we started having a hierarchy on the DART teams. Before, the DART team, everybody just kind of did things. Now everybody has a job description. They have to have trained. You have to be certified. You can't go on the DART team. There are huge logistics warehouses for the DART teams now. There's a big, there is like 30 armored vehicles in reserve in one of the Gulf states. Dubai, is it? Dubai, and there's huge amounts of, and we modeled that after the military, actually. Mike Hess was the assistant administrator of what's now called DACHA, Democracy, Conflict, Humanitarian Assistance. He's a former colonel, which is one reason I asked him, the president, of course, named him the position with Senate confirmation, but because he was a retired colonel who had many years of experience in these emergencies, I said he gets it. We also created, while he was the head, the Office of Military Affairs. And I remember the personnel office saying, Andrew, no one from the Foreign Service is going to volunteer for that. They don't like the military and aid. You know, they have memories of Vietnam. No one volunteered. We had 125 Foreign Service officers willing to change their backstops, which is, we call backstop, the State Department calls it a cone. You know, the military has MOSs. So it's the equivalent. 125 senior immediately volunteered. We had too many of them to put in this new office. The office now has 40 people in it, 20 colonels seconded on a rotating basis from the Pentagon, and 20 civil servants and foreign service in this office that was created in 2005. So there's been an evolution of steps taken to increase our formal relationship. We now have senior foreign service officers at all the regional combatant commands, which you never did before. We only had them, I think, in Southcom, but we have them in UCOM, we have them in AFRICOM, we have them in PACOM, and those relationships over time developed into, I think, a much greater level of respect by our officers of the military and of the military for what we can do that they can do well.
General Garner?
I think, Karen, there were several things that happened and provide comfort that I haven't seen happen since then. One is the press was very, very friendly, extremely friendly. And I think the first...
Friendly,
very nice to us. And what happened, the first or second day we were there, Jim Jones came to me. He said, you know, we got a lot of press around here. We had no press was everywhere. And he said, let's make them our friend. I said, that's a great idea. How you want to do that? And he said, here's how we do it. He said, let's be open to them. Tell them what's going on. Let them talk to everybody. And if there's an open seat on a Jeep, a truck, or an aircraft, let them get on it. And we did. And they were extremely friendly after that. And I had one or two press conferences with them where things happened. I didn't want that to get out. And I said, I'm going to tell you this, but I'm going to ask you not to publish it. And they didn't. Which I thought was unique, very unique. The next thing that happened is General Galvin, who was in the Supreme Allied Commander, got Dick Nabb, who was our negotiator in East Germany with the Russians. And he brought Dick Nabb from there and put him in northern Iraq and established what we call the MCC, the Military Coordination Center. And Dick then established liaison with the Iraqi generals. So he had meetings every day with the Iraqi generals. He had his hand on their pulse. And when we were told we couldn't go into Dahut, Dick went into the Iraqi generals, and he said, look, you made a bad decision here. The reason you want them to go into Dahut is because they're going to get all these refugees out of the mountains, and that's going to be better press for you if they do that. He talked them into doing that. So that was something I don't think we've had since then.
Did you think all these civilians, all these diplomatic types were getting in the way?
No. Big force multipliers. The other thing that happened there is about 3 or 4 weeks into the operation, the NGOs decided they were going to be part of the team. And I attribute that to USAID and Fred Cooney because they had long meetings with them. And then we did the same thing with the NGOs. Hey, get on the helicopter. You need something. We'll get it for you, et cetera, et cetera. And they're tremendous force multipliers. And then the final thing were the Kurds themselves. The Kurds were extremely friendly. Now, the Kurds got in a lot of firefights with the Iraqis, and you could understand that. But the PUK and the KDP joined hands. They provided liaison to me. I always had my pulse on what they were doing. They had their pulse on what I was doing. Dick had his pulse on what the Iraqis were doing. So we kept from bumping into each other dangerously.
Well, you've actually alluded to something I wanted to ask Professor Saleh about. You talked about how the Americans and the coalition kept out of the way of Kurds who were trying to build institutions. This was a time when the Kurds themselves were divided and had been for a number of years. How did you, we talk frequently in these operations in this country about providing space for the people on the ground to do what they need to do in a safe environment. How did you use that time, and how were those divisions overcome to put in place the institutions that you talked about earlier?
I think it had a shock effect, because when the whole population was on the run, it's a population that's been traumatized previously. Despite all the difficulties between the political parties, they had to take responsibility when they got back, and they had to administer the population. You have to remember also the area, the safety zone was only one quarter of the entire population of the Kurdistan, or in territory of Kurdistan. Even later, when the no-fly zone was set up, it covered only half of the territory in which the Kurds lived. But in the shadow of the safe zone and the no-fly zone, the Kurds had to take responsibility. And in a fascinating way, the transition from resistance into civilians created at least two peaceful years of coexistence between the political parties, in which they formed the first regional government, the parliament, and set up the institutions. And unfortunately, for a lot of understandable reasons, they had a lot of clashes after that. But in what's now later called the Washington Agreement in 1998, the area went through a peaceful political development. And that allowed the Kurds to try, by trial and error, setting up their own institutions, but also remaining within the limit of, or the limitation of, what they were allowed to do. They never went into independence discussions seriously at that time. So they reduced all the tensions in the regional level. At the same time, because they knew that Resolution 688 mandated also the UN to protect the civilians, they also realized that their plight, the plight of the Kurdish civilians, also initiated a discussion that later led to the documents published by UN in 10 years later called Responsibility to Protect. So they knew that they had to take responsibility first internally in order to be protected also externally. So that was a very interesting transition. You can only see that and compare it with what happened later in South Africa, when a revolutionary movement, a resistance movement, taking over a state and doing civilian politics for quite a long time. And this particular experience in Kurdistan has not been well studied and well understood in order to be replicated in other parts of the world, because we're talking about, as you said, a lot of internal fighting and difficulties and very difficult neighborhoods. Despite that, they created an oasis of peaceful developments for quite a long time, despite sanctions by UN, sanctions by Iraq, and sanctions and sabotage by neighboring countries. They survived for almost 12, 13 years under very harsh circumstances. And they managed to take that lesson into the negotiation table in 2003, when we were in Baghdad and negotiating, you could see the level of sophistication by the Kurdish negotiators that was entirely different compared with the Shias, who did not have had that opportunity to administer their own population, because they came back from opposition immediately and were put in place in responsibility, and they had to negotiate a constitution for the future of Iraq, which unfortunately went wrong quite dramatically later.
Thank you. Yes.
Can I just say one quick thing to your question to Andrew and Jay? I think based on what I saw my last time in government, we're doing a better job on post-conflict from the ground up. But it has to be integrated into the senior levels of the national security interagency process earlier, with clear identification of issues and a clear identification of the chain of command. Whoever is going to have responsibility for that post-conflict setting needs to be part of the senior discussion in the run-up to the war, during the war itself. He or she cannot simply be brought in as an afterthought. We did a lot of thinking about war aims, whether to go to Baghdad, what to do if Saddam used unconventional weapons. We wrote papers on them. We ran them up. We did not look as carefully as we should have at, again, those unpredictable consequences of success. It's clear that the State Department has the lead until the first shot is fired. It's clear defense has the lead during the fighting. It's still a jump ball once things end on who is in charge, particularly when you have a lot of boots on the ground. Military has a very strong role. And so, again, I think what I don't want to see is this good work that's being done from the ground up dissipated because it's not taken into account early enough, clearly enough, with, again, a clearly defined post-conflict chain of command defined early on. And I think you'll discuss that this afternoon.
You can see that the question is whether those lessons, those hard-learned lessons at that point were remembered, 13 years later in the same
anecdote.
In the same country.
In 2003, before the Iraq War started, I was approached about whether I would want to lead the post-conflict situation in Iraq. I was one of a number of people who were spoken to. And I said, listen, you know, I've got an important job in the private sector, but, you know, if we're going to put troops in harm's way, of course, I'll say yes if asked. But I have just two questions. To whom would I report, and can I start tomorrow?
Mm-hmm.
And the person I was talking to said, I can't answer either question. And my response was, I'm not your man.
I don't think they ever did answer that.
No.
Well, I might add that when, and I'm not just saying it because he's sitting here, we had a little celebration in aid when General Garner was appointed as the head of the reconstruction effort because he understood aid and respectful of aid. That was not the case after that. And I don't want to go into that here, but Jake, we actually celebrated, and a lot of the career senior staff who knew him, and he said he's a hero in Kurdistan. He knows what to do, and he knows what we do, and so we work very well with you early on. I'll leave it at that.
We want to get some questions from all of y'all to any of our panelists. Do we have microphones? I'm not great. Okay, and if you could, I'll call on you, and if you could identify yourself, and you can ask a question to anyone or to all of the panelists. Yes, sir, over here.
Thank you very much, Karen. I am Dr. Nisar Chaudhary with the Pakistan American League. My question is for General Garner, but anybody can also give his input. He had mentioned that he, during that operation, he clearly know what he's not supposed to do, but he exactly did not know what he should exactly do. And then he mentioned about Kuwait, that we did not have the post-victory strategy. My question is it a pattern in Afghanistan, first Afghan war, and now after the regime change, Osama is killed, Umar is killed, then in Iraq, the autocratic or barbarian ruler has gone, and then in Libya, what is happening now? Then Fallujah is being working very hard to get it back. Then Syria, the regime is going to be changed. Is it a pattern that there is no post-victory strategy, or the post-victory strategy does not work, or it is so unpredictable that it is not possible to have a post-victory strategy which is effective? Thank you.
I'm not sure I understood that.
I think it's that it's saying, what did we learn from all of this? We had something that actually succeeded, and yet you can look at many places now. You look at Iraq, after 2003. You look at Libya, you look at Afghanistan, and certain parts of Pakistan where you don't see perhaps these lessons coming into play. Is that?
I think, or
is it that these situations are so different and so fraught and so fast moving that it's really not possible?
Well, I think when you compare 91 to 2003, the big difference there is in 91 you had the guys that fought the war, and then as soon as it was over you had the guys that came in and did post-war. And so there was no question on the part of the guys that came in and did post-war that wasn't their mission. They had that to do. In 2003, you had the guys
just stayed.
And they were told that they weren't going to stay very long, and they were ready to go. They weren't really interested in post-war because they'd never entered in what they were doing, except in a little bit of planning with small groups, but it didn't permeate through the force. So that was a huge, huge difference in culture between those two. And I'm going to tell you, I have said for years, and I failed to do this when I was in the military, although I tried, is I think that part of the annual testing of the combat units that we do at the National Training Center, that there ought to be 2 weeks tacked onto that is all post-war work. Because in the military, you become perfect at what you're tested on. And you really don't much give a damn on what you're not tested on. Yeah. So until you start testing them, they're not going to do it very well.
Can I just add, there was a study done by the CIA, I think in the late 90s, by Ted Gurr at the University of Maryland with a couple of other scholars. And they looked at development and they looked at emergencies in failed states. And what they found is that all successful states that move from being poor to wealthy look the same. There's differences, but they have similar institutions. There's export-led economic growth, like South Korea is a huge success. We spent $6 billion, people forget that. We had a huge aid mission in South Korea and in Taiwan and a bunch of other countries. They all look the same in many respects after it's all over. What they found is every complex emergency was different. It was driven by one region, who your neighbors are. Two, it's the quality of the local leaders. I mean, Americans are, especially in Washington, think that if they put enough money into something, they can change everything on the ground. That's complete nonsense. The reason Kurdistan worked is because the Kurds are there. That's why it worked. And I'm not just complimenting them, but that's why. I mean, if we didn't have the Kurds there and we had other places the career staff would say, Andrew, it doesn't make any difference how much money we spend or how many people we put in. If the military coordinates, this is going to be a failure because of who we're dealing with. The region we're in, the elites are basically, in some countries, extraordinarily abusive, extraordinarily corrupt. They don't have any vision for the society at all. And when that happens, it doesn't make any difference. Americans cannot reconstruct the society from outside. If you have the leaders with some vision, you know, they don't have to be an American vision. In fact, it's best if it's a local vision of what they want to be and where they are. Then, I mean, if we hadn't had, President Park was criticized in South Korea for human rights abuses. But frankly, if President Park had not been the leader in South Korea, I'm not sure Korea would be where it is now. But he actually internalized a lot of the development theory that we sent like 30 economists in over a period of 2 decades. And he absorbed it, and the same thing happened in Taiwan. So I think it does, who the local leaders are, who the elites are, whether they are willing to make progress and take some risks. A lot of the local elites don't want to take any risks.
Can I build on that issue? May I build on that issue?
Yes. I'm sorry. Excuse me. Just one second.
Yeah. If I may, I would say the fact that the Kurds managed to take responsibility is also because they have been pragmatically aware of their limitations in the wider context of the Middle East. Now, they didn't want to risk players to come in and transform the little Kurdistan they had control over into a new Lebanon. They were very, very much aware of the risks. That's why they never politicized in a big way what they were doing in terms of institution building. So they downplayed and build a trial and error with a lot of difficulties and also sometimes mistakes. But that is the credit, that is where we need to look at and see what kind of lessons we can learn when you look at institution buildings without making a big political statement about it.
It's an interesting point. Yes, ma'am.
I'm Mitzi Wertheim with the Naval Postgraduate School. My question actually is for you. Two words I keep hearing in Washington are about trust and relationships, and that has to be what's going on. I would add to that complexity and understanding. And my question is, how do we get the media to tell these stories so we understand what's actually going on, how these processes work, and don't have what I call inappropriate expectations for success?
You know, I think that the media now, it's very difficult to define the media now. I mean, I can define it what I think it is, but there's such a wide range of information sources available to people that I think it's easy to concentrate on the superficial and the sort of, I guess what we would call clickbait. But there's a lot of good journalism being done. There's a lot of in-depth journalism being done. Sometimes it's a little bit harder to find than maybe it was before. But I think that for anybody who has the persistence and can sit there at the keyboard, it's there. There's a lot. I got an email just last week from a high school teacher who said they'd already given their exams and had an extra week, and she wanted to explain to her students what Syria was all about, and said, I don't know where to start. I don't know what to give them to read that they can digest. I don't know, in the weeds of this huge amount of information, what I can give them to look at. And, you know, can you help? And I spent literally 20 minutes finding, there were some good, some of it were Congressional Research Service reports, because they do, I think, a very good job. But there were lots of places, BBC, we've done it, the New York Times, Atlantic Magazine, some of the think tanks have really produced really digestible, very objective looks at what's from beginning to now, how we got here. And I think that stuff does exist. And I think it exists still with daily journalism now. It's a little bit harder because there's not as much money, but I think it's still there.
Sykes-Picot, 1916, and then you figure out why it doesn't work.
Right. Yes, ma'am.
Elaine Serrao, Associate Rector of WIUU. So many of the points that have been already stated has come together in my question, and I'm so glad that Karen brought up the topic of Syria. Gentlemen, I very much appreciate everything you've presented today about the success of what you were engaged in Kurdistan, and how it, without what you did, things would have been incredibly different, and sadly so. I would like to ask how, though, that this was 25 years ago, the success of the operation, and when we fast forward through the 25 years of dealing with efforts in Bosnia-Herzegovina, in Rwanda, in Afghanistan, and so on, and we can look at these efforts to the time where we are presently with Syria. And how can we look at how the successes really haven't come forward the way one would hope, not only because of some of the things you've said that could be done differently, but what else could possibly be done? USAID, before Congress in 2014, tried to address the $102 billion spent between 2002 and 2012, and to be able to show where the successes were and how really little success we really had for $102 billion.
I think this is something that the panel this afternoon is going to go into. I don't know if anybody wants to quickly
add, that 102 includes the military's part of it, which was far bigger than AID. We did not spend $102 billion in Afghanistan. I know exactly what the budgets were. They're actually a relatively modest part of that. And we actually do have very substantial success stories. The problem is there is a inspector general, in my view, special inspector general in Afghanistan who is out of control, who is writing things that are outrageous and inaccurate, who is throwing bombs, and he's getting away with it. Now, there have been a couple of stories out now that people are beginning to ask in Congress, where's the evidence for what you're saying? You keep saying these outrageous things. If you read the audits, they're different than what are in the press releases and the statements that he's making.
To the point you've just made, I mean, again, it's what is does get out to the public, to the media, to the world. And then we have a situation like Syria where the umpty-umpty years of exhaustion and the world, not just the U.S., is and the U.S. even, and particularly the U.S. in the media, in some areas of the media, is totally non-supportive of any refugee efforts whatsoever.
I'm going to cut you off because that's a little bit off our current topic. But hopefully, no, some of those questions hopefully will be addressed this afternoon. There was this gentleman back here had a question.
I'm Christopher Blanchard from the Congressional Research Service, actually. So thank you for the plug.
I hope the check's in the mail.
I wanted to circle back to, I think there's a lot of interest in this case study, principally because of the Syria situation presently. And I think some of the difficulty with regard to a response to the Syria refugee crisis has been at the Security Council. And so if we look back to 688, it's arguable whether it actually provided the sort of basis for the military operation that took place, the no-fly zones that were subsequently imposed. General Garner, you made very clear that what this may ultimately boil down to is very tough conversations in the military coordination committees with Iraqi generals and saying, look, if this happens again, we're going to come in here and kill every one of you. We simply don't have that basis and that kind of consensus, and arguably you may not have at that time. So if you could all comment a bit about that sort of intersection between the military and diplomatic, how important something like that would be in an operation, particularly in the Syria context, but others that may be under current consideration. Thank you.
Andrew hit on it. The success of Provide Comfort was the Kurds. I mean, we were dealing with the Kurds. The Kurds were, they wanted what we were doing. They wanted to help us. They did help us. It was a very successful, and they made it easy for us. The rest of the world in that way, and when you take different tribes, different religions, and different ethnicities, and you put them, try to put them in the same mixing bowl, say you're going to live there, when they say we don't want to live here, we're not going to live here, it just doesn't work. And we have to get off a 19th century mindset of drawing straight lines and things like that and see where the new world is today and how you get people to live together. And you may have to take them and put them in partitions or something else where they are comfortable in their own environment. Otherwise, I don't care how much money you throw at it, I don't care how much doctrine you write, it ain't going to work.
But I wonder how much of it is what Professor Sahli said. I mean, this was not a nation-building exercise. This was providing the space and the security for them to build their own nation. Now, the Kurds may have been particularly well-prepared to do that. But it seems to me it was a bit different in terms of U.S. policy, too. I mean, and it would be hard to find a comparable situation where that happened. Maybe the Balkans a bit. But
AID spent almost $800 million after this was over. And that a lot of that was humanitarian relief, but we call it developmental relief. We did things that rehabilitated the economy locally. Some of it was food aid, admittedly, but there were creative ways of using humanitarian relief for developmental purposes that helped facilitate the leadership that the Kurds were already providing. And so that was done, and there was no troops in them. There may have been a small number of troops, but the troops had been withdrawn. It was the NGOs, the UN and AID, and other donors that were there as well. But AID spent a lot of money over a four-year period between the Bush administration and the Clinton administration. This was over both administrations, $794 million. That's a lot of money. In a country of how many, were there 5 million Kurds? How many people were in northern Iraq, something like that?
5 million.
That's a lot of money for a relatively small number of people. Mm-hmm.
Did you, Bob?
Karen, I was just going to say that no matter what the circumstance is, you have to have a well-coordinated political, military, economic plan that has to have a humanitarian refugee assistance component, hopefully done on an international coalition basis. UN Foundation is always the best. Harder for people to say no to the UN than it is to say no to the US. But if you can't get it, that doesn't stop you from trying to put it together. But even as we deal with sort of the urgent issues in a place like Syria, you know, we have to keep asking the important questions. And I would say, particularly at the Middle East Institute, an important question would be, why is that strategic region, the Middle East, such a location today of instability and human tragedy, the only region of the world without a multilateral development bank? We've got an Asia Development Bank, Inter-American Development Bank, European Bank for Reconstruction Development, Africa Development Bank. There's not one in the Middle East. There are some idiosyncratic banks in the Gulf region, but no one is looking at the Middle East on a development basis. Every place else in the world. And I would say, if you look at the communique of the G7 leaders coming out of Japan 10 days ago, they've set up a special financing facility for the Middle East. I hope that'll be the start of that group, and I hope more broadly the G20, looking beyond the tragedy of Syria to say that over time, without creating jobs and opportunity for that next generation, we're going to be dealing with this in another 25 years.
Karen, may I have a comment here?
Yes, you may have the last word.
Okay, thank you. I think we are stuck in our discussion about what's wrong with the Middle East because we only go back to the Sykes-Picot. But we forget the 500 years of Ottoman misrule. And I think much of the explanation lies in the Ottoman rule for the failure of Middle East currently. We can't find the answers in Sykes-Picot.
Thank you. Thank you all. We've run out of time. I think we could go on for a lot longer, but thank you very much to our panelists.